Have you noticed how leading intellectuals, commentators, and our political leaders, they all too often tell us we live in uncertain and volatile times? That Australians have never been so anxious about the world and our place in it. Now, you may recall Julie Bishop in her controversial speech in Singapore several weeks ago. She gave voice to those concerns, didn't she? And at one level, those fears are entirely understandable. Brexit, the success of Trump last year, the populist wave across Europe, the rise of China, all that. And yet, Australians have been anxious in the past too. We feared abandonment, originally Britain, then by the United States. My guest today is uniquely placed to delve deeper into this issue and to explain how past policymakers and political leaders dealt with dramatic shifts on the global stage and what all that meant for Australia and our role in the world. Alan Gingell is author of Fear of Abandonment, Australia in the World Since 1942, published by La Trobe University Press. He was Senior Foreign Policy Advisor to Prime Minister Paul Keating, Director General of Office of National Assessments, and the founding Executive Director of the Lowy Institute. And these days, he's based at the Australian National University's Crawford School in Canberra. Alan, welcome to Between the Lines.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
Alan, when do you think Australia developed an independent foreign policy? Was it when we became an independent state in 1901?
We certainly didn't think in 1901 that we were developing an independent foreign policy. We thought of ourselves as part of a great British empire in which we would play a part, but we were certainly a branch office of that empire rather than a country with our own foreign policy. We really didn't develop a foreign policy until 1942, which is when we ratified belatedly, 11 years after the legislation had been passed, the Statute of Westminster, which the British Parliament had passed earlier, giving the dominions of the Crown the authority to have a sovereign identity in the world, to sign treaties, to have embassies overseas and so on. So, you know, we only did it when staring in the face of a Japanese advance on our shores.
That's right. I mean, these were anxious times. You had the fall of Singapore, the Japanese move towards Australia, the Darwin, and of course the Battle of the Coral Sea, where commemorating the 75th anniversary in recent weeks. But of course, even before then, when we were a collection of colonies far removed from the Western world, we were always anxious about the mother country and whether it was indifferent to our interests and priorities in the Pacific, weren't we?
Oh, absolutely. That fear was around the fear of abandonment compared with the fear of foreign entanglements, which is what the American founding fathers were concerned about. It was there from the beginning, and it was a completely logical fear, Tom. I mean, here we were making an audacious claim to a continent located a long way from the markets for our products and the places from which most of us, except Indigenous Australians, came. So, you know, it was not a stupid anxiety to have.
No, indeed. And then, of course, we became anxious in the aftermath of World War II and the onset of the Cold War when we had decolonisation, particularly in our neighbourhood. How did we respond to the rise of Asian nationalism after World War II, Alan?
Well, with anxiety, because we didn't expect it to come on us as quickly as it did. But on the whole, pretty well, I think. The challenge of what to do about the Indonesian independence struggle was really the first foreign policy issue that the government faced after the end of the war, and I think we handled that pretty well. Similarly, I think, as the other countries of the region, Malaya, Indochina, became independent, we managed to establish our own independent set of interests in those countries and to lay the foundations for what would become very productive relationships.
And especially when it came to Indonesia. You know, reading your book, Alan, I immediately thought of Sir Alan Watt, who was a prominent Mandarin, former ambassador. And 50 years ago, 1967, he wrote a book called The Evolution of Australian Foreign Policy. In some respects, I think, in a way, your book is in the same genre, a very exceptional book in the sense of really explaining the history of Australian foreign policy. But I was going through it the other night, and I looked at this quote from Watt Few international problems in the post-war period, and he's writing this in 67, have proved as difficult for Australia as the development of a friendly and effective policy towards Indonesia. Nothing's changed in half a century, Alan.
He was perceptive there, wasn't he? Well, that's right. I mean, it's very hard to think of two neighbouring countries in the world which are more different from each other than Australia and Indonesia. So it's always going to be a tough task. They're a porous archipelago. We're a large continent. We see our security coming from an alliance with a great and powerful friend. They see it as coming from non-alignment. And so we look at the world in very different ways, and very often there have been sort of hiccups along the route. We've been overly transactional in the way we've approached them on issues like refugees and terrorism and so on. But look, on the whole, you know, here we are at peace, and despite the fact that we sort of glance at each other with narrowed eyes from time to time, it's not a bad relationship.
Indeed. The conventional wisdom, I think, Alan, certainly among intellectuals, is that Australia during this period in the late 40s, throughout the 50s and even 60s, we weren't really as engaged with Asia as we should have been. Now, during a recent event at Sydney's Glee Books, you said that Sir Robert Menzies, quote, got almost everything wrong on foreign policy. But what about his trade deal in 1957 with Japan? Now, before you answer that, this is former Liberal Prime Minister John Howard. He told me last year, after I asked him about the Labor critique of Menzies' Asia attitude, specifically Labor's treatment of Menzies' Japan trade deal.
Well, I suppose the first thing they should try and do is explain why the Labor Party of the day voted against it in the Parliament. This was, more than anything else, the deed that unlocked the Asian market to Australia. It was a remarkable thing. 12 years after World War II, people in his own ministry, like the late Alec Downer, Alexander Downer's father, who'd been a prisoner of war.
At Changi,
mm-hmm. And people like Reg Swartz. And on the other side, there were
Labor side,
there'd been people in a similar situation. And it was a remarkable act of foresight. And it meant that when Britain decided to enter the European Union, history being unwound now, in the early 70s, mm-hmm. and with the benefit of the iron ore discoveries in Western Australia, the way was smooth for Australia to embrace Japan as a great export destination. And that was the opening of Asia to Australia.
That's right.
More than anything else now. I don't decry the contribution Whitlam made in relation to China, certainly not. You've got to recognise that. But if you're looking to the Asian story, which is so important to the wealth of modern Australia, it was Menzies and McEwen who did the legwork, who really blazed the trail in relation to trade with Japan.
John Howard on Between the Lines on Menzies opening Asia to Australia. Alan Gingell.
Look, there's no doubt that the Menzies government did several important and lasting things in foreign policy. The alliance with the United States, the Colombo Plan, the Commerce Treaty with Japan, the way in which they managed confrontation with Indonesia. All quite good. But my point really was that this was often despite Menzies and not because of it. And I'm not simply sort of giving my own views here. You read what Spender or what Casey or what his colleagues were saying about him. Menzies was not a man who was comfortable with the world that was coming. Now, on the Japan Commerce Treaty, it was indeed a very important development, but it was largely McEwen and the Country Party who drove it. Menzies, it was noted by his colleagues, absented himself from the final cabinet meeting on the treaty, and the speculation among his colleagues was that this was so that if things went badly wrong, his fingerprint wouldn't be upon it. So, yeah, of course, good things were done during that period, but Menzies himself was uneasy with the world that he was confronted by, and that had consequences, I think, later.
And now is as good a time as any to remind everyone that Menzies backed the wrong side in the Suez Crisis of 56. He supported Britain and France and Israel, not the Americans who opposed the intervention in Suez, right?
That's right, and that was really the snapping point for the US-British relationship and the point at which it became clear that the world, you know, the pre-war world in which Britain was a major global power could no longer continue.
My guest is Alan Gingell, the former foreign policy Mandarin, who's author of Fear of Abandonment, Australia in the World Since 1942. Alan, take us back to the late 60s, early 70s. You know, the British, and you document this in great detail in your book, the British withdrew east of Suez. They were in the process of joining the European community. President Nixon set out the Guam Doctrine that set out limits to US power, encouraging US allies to become more independent, more assertive. Question, how unsettling was this for Australians at the time?
It was very unsettling, Tom. I often think that that period was the most stressful for Australia. And if you're looking for sort of comparisons with the world now, the uncertainties in the world now, I think you have to go back to that period. Our economy was so deeply plugged in to the UK, and suddenly that was all changing. They were about to join the European Union. So Australians were no longer going to be able to move and live in the UK as we'd done before. And mm-hmm. the Americans themselves looked as though they were wandering over to the other side of the Pacific as well. It was
after the debacle in Vietnam, that's right.
After the debacle in Vietnam.
You say, Alan, our behaviour during this period, late 60s, early 70s, was, quote, graceless and self-absorbed. This was also the time of John Gorton's new nationalism, right?
Yes, that's right. That's right. That was one of the responses that came out of Australian governments at the time, foreshadowing in some ways some of the things that Whitlam did a couple of years later. But no, on the whole, we were very whingy. I mean, there was nothing that the Brits could do about their sort of economic circumstances. It was inevitable that they're going to have to look to the continent. But all we were concerned about were the, you know, the market for our fruit and so on.
And 1969, remember, that was the year you joined the Department for External Affairs, I think it was called back then. What did you make of the churn as a young chap just out of university going into the Foreign Service?
Well, I knew that, you know, this was a very exciting time to be working on foreign policy because a whole lot of things had to happen. They hadn't yet happened at that point. For example, we hadn't yet recognised China. The White Australia policy was sort of in its last, you know, painful period.
I mean, you made it clear that the New Zealanders ended discrimination on immigration almost 20 years earlier.
Yeah, the New Zealanders and the Canadians. You know, most others had made these changes, which were blindingly obvious.
Mm. Why were we so reluctant to embrace change, do you think, even in the mid to late 60s?
I think it was a political thing, Tom. I think that the coalition government had simply worked itself into a policy cul-de-sac. And you often see this with long-standing governments. I mean, they find themselves unable to move even on things where they know they should move. And they knew they should move on Vietnam. They knew they should move on the White Australia policy. They knew they should move on recognition of China. But they just couldn't do it. And that made it very easy, of course, for Whitlam to come in that sort of dramatic opening.
So in other words, all that anxiety then in the late 60s and early 70s, the fear of abandonment, it prompted an activist foreign policy in the Whitlam era.
That's right. Exactly. And a foreign policy that was continued, you know, very much by Fraser and Peacock.
Yeah, that's right. That's interesting. So in the 70s, we did have this breakdown of this rigid Cold War bipolarity. You make that clear in your book. So it was the Nixon, Kissinger, Carter era in the United States. And we conformed to that. We adjusted policy in accordance with the breakdown of that bipolarity, didn't we?
Yeah, the worst days of the Cold War were over the most sort of terrifying period, the sort of Cuban Missile Crisis and so on were over. And we were beginning to be able to do things in the world. You know, the strategic arms and negotiations and so on were going on.
Again, my guest is Alan Gingell, author of a new book called Fear of Abandonment. He's one of our most distinguished former diplomats and mandarins. Alan, question for you. You know, we come to the end of the Cold War in the late 80s, early 1990s. Another prominent book was written during this period by Gareth Evans, the foreign minister in the early 1990s, with Bruce Grant. I can only think of your book and Watt's book that we mentioned earlier as being the best books on this subject. But with the end of the Cold War, some might have argued that if US alliance was created at the height of the Cold War in 51, then the case for the alliance after the Cold War was less clear. How come your boss, Paul Keating, wasn't keen to jettison the alliance given the changed circumstances?
Well, because I think he was nothing if not a realist in his approach to the world. He's nothing if not a realist in his approach to the world, Keating. And he had no problems with our having an alliance relationship with the US. It was just the nature of what we did under that alliance that mattered. Certainly the end of the Cold War meant that it was possible to do a whole range of things that hadn't been done until that point. So the focus of Australian foreign policy during that period in things like the Cambodian peace settlement and the Chemical Weapons Convention and so on was suddenly embracing these things which were now possible to do. Geoeconomics had replaced geopolitics. And so when Keating and Bill Clinton got together, it was sort of economic issues that they were talking about, not security.
Well, here's a provocative question for you. If the alliance were not around today, would there still be a need to create it?
It depends what you mean by the alliance, Tom. I mean, you know, the ANZUS Treaty basically says, look, if things go wrong, give us a call and we'll have a chat about what to do. That's on both sides. I mean, that's the nature of the alliance. The relationship with the United States is much deeper and broader and based on, you know, a whole range of different cultural and economic issues. So the relationship with the United States, I think, would always be around. There will always be issues on which we will want to work closely with the Americans.
But since the end of the Cold War, there have been tensions. I mean, Iraq comes to mind, widely regarded as John Howard's biggest mistake in office. What did Saddam Hussein ever do to Australia? This is what our old friend Owen Harris has often quipped. What did Saddam Hussein ever do to Australia other than buy our wheat? I mean, was it just because of the alliance we went into Iraq?
I think it was very heavily because of the alliance. And all you have to do is to read the sort of statements that John Howard was making at the time. The metaphor of the insurance treaty, I say in the book, is the most powerful metaphor in Australian public life. And the idea that you have to continue to pay a premium so that if the conflagration comes, the payout will follow was very heavily in the mind of the government. And that was what crafted the actual way in which we went into Iraq, which was early and publicly. But we also got out very, very quickly.
That's right. I mean, people do forget that despite the grandstanding and what some might say was the unqualified and unconditional nature of our support for Washington and Britain, nevertheless, Australia didn't really pay much of a price, certainly not in the region, for our intervention in Iraq.
Yeah, not in Iraq, no. There was a higher price to be paid in Afghanistan, but that was a whole different...
And yet you'll often hear the laments. It's predominantly on the left. Bruce Grant, for example, Alison Bronowski, they'll say that Australia still does not have an independent foreign policy, that we're still American lickspittles. How would you respond to that argument?
Look, I don't buy that argument. I certainly think that there are things that we've done in foreign policy terms, and Iraq was one of them, that we ought not to have done, but I don't think we've done it because we're American lickspittles. We've been manipulators of the alliance at least as much, I think, as the Americans have in reverse. So you can argue about whether we should have done some of the things that we have done, but we weren't, you know, strong-armed into this by the Americans. We went willingly.
Okay. Alan, does China change things, though? I mean, you know, with the rise of China, many say that our alliance with our great and powerful friend will change. Before you answer that, let's get your reaction to something Professor John Mearsheimer, he's the distinguished Chicago University political scientist. I often run this quote by distinguished guests, Alan. This is what he told me about a year ago.
Well, I think in a scenario where China is even more powerful than it is today, and the United States is consumed putting together a balancing coalition to contain China, any country in East Asia that does not cooperate with the United States, and this would be especially true of a country like Australia, would feel the white heat of anger from Uncle Sam. Uncle Sam would go to great lengths to coerce the Australians or the Japanese or the Filipinos, whoever, into working with the United States to deal with China. The United States would be very angry if the Australians tried to sort of cut a side deal with the Chinese and cooperate with the Chinese and not work with the United States to contain China.
That's Professor John Mearsheimer, the Distinguished Professor of International Relations at Chicago University, on why Australia should go all the way with the USA in the event of a stoush with China, Alan Gingell.
John's a very powerful thinker and arguer, and I admire him greatly. And we had a bet a couple of years ago when he was out in Australia that, you know, I thought that the US and the Americans would be able to manage through this period. John was absolutely of the view that, you know, storm clouds are coming.
But his point, though, there are costs to Australia if we don't give strong support to the US in any security competition with Beijing, right?
It depends on what the circumstances are. You can't really just sort of say that, because we can't know what is the sort of provocation that leads to it. If the, you know, Chinese were to go into the, you know, Senkaku Islands, for example, and simply take them over, that's one set of problems. If the Americans blindly and blunderingly suddenly, you know, find themselves about to go to war with China, I think the range of responses that we can give is greater than John allows in that.
So circumstances should determine policy. That's sound advice. Meanwhile, you've got Hugh White, another old friend of ours from ANU. He was writing recently in the East Asia Forum, an excellent website published by ANU. This is what he said. He predicted that in the Trump era, the US will likely stumble thoughtlessly into a war with China or retreat from the region or both. Your thoughts?
I don't think it can easily do either. I mean, Hugh might be right. I mean, who knows? Every conversation any of us have had over the past few months, Tom, has sort of ended on some variation of who knows. But I think that the likelihood of either a stumble into war or an ignominious retreat is less than the management through this of something which will not be like the circumstances we have now, but will be sufficiently reassuring for US allies in the region like Japan to enable us to go forward. I mean, the real danger for the region is if the Japanese decide that they don't have any faith in US extended nuclear deterrence and need to develop their own nuclear weapons. So I think the pressures on the US will be sufficient to prevent either of those things.
Indeed. I mean, on that note, I mean, is our present political leadership in Canberra capable of thinking in your terms? I mean, you do say in your book towards the end that Julie Bishop is, quote, not a conceptual thinker. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that she's in a longer tradition of foreign ministers who have been diplomats and doers, people like, you know, Casey in a way, Willacy, Peacock, Stephen Smith. You can only measure this by, you know, what she says, and she has given very few large-scale speeches about the sort of world that she thinks we... I mean, you alluded to the...
Singapore Japan, speech.
Singapore one. I mean, that was unusual because it was the first one that I can recall in which she tried to address this. Now, presumably the foreign policy white paper that she's instituted now is an effort to address those conceptual questions. I'm a skeptic about foreign policy white papers generally, but that...
Why is that? Because
foreign policy deals with a messy, contingent and constantly changing world. And if the foreign policy white paper had come out this time last year, it wouldn't have expected Donald Trump to...
Indeed. But would you say the same thing about defence white papers, Alan?
Not so much, because defence white papers, you're setting out purchases, equipment, platforms that are going to be lasting 30 years or so. So the point of a defence white paper is rather different. It's to say we're going to develop submarines or whatever, and you have to do that in some form. Foreign policy is more easily, in my view anyway, managed by sort of frequent speeches to Parliament, which account for the adjustments that you have to make.
Well, your book reveals the history of our role in the world, Alan, and I think by doing that, you've also laid the foundations for understanding future challenges. Lovely chatting with you today. All the best with the book. Thanks so much for being on Between the Lines.
Thanks so much, Tom. Good to be with you.
That was Alan Gingell, author of Fear of Abandonment, Australia in the World Since 1942, published by La Trobe University Press.